Lilly sit on the Archbishop's Council. We also have an Archdiocesan Council and also the clergy. All of them have been dear friends. It's one of my great joy and outlets of fellowship, and just it makes the CC a little smaller in terms of relationship and that kind of thing. And he's been just a dear friend, loyal brother who I really trust, and he likes chicken fried steak.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome. It makes me very proud of him. I dream about chicken fried steak, large chicken fried steak. But I'm so glad that he came, and Cindy's with him. She's not feeling really good, but I'm so grateful that they came to be with us. And so, dear friend, come and share the word of the Lord with us. Just welcome the man of God. You can grab this chair. David, you can do what you want.
No, I got it adjusted already.
Is it okay to have the chair, too?
Sure.
I use it.
Okay.
Now, this one right here, this is the best one. This is the most comfortable one for older gentlemen.
Yes. That's right. Thank you. That's right.
Yeah, it gives you that Harley feel.
That's okay.
That's the closest to a Harley that I do. See, they wonder sometimes under my breath, and I sound like the bishop's like going,
That's right.
It's only when I sit in that chair.
When the Archbishop Chuck suggested that we get together periodically for fellowship, I knew that it was God because he suggested that we meet in Auburn. I thought maybe he was terminal. I was trying to make things right. That's right. That's right. So, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. When he asked me to come, and I said, "What do you want me to speak about?" And he said, "Well, I kind of whatever you want, but if you want to share what the Lord has been doing with you and showing you during Lent, that would be good." And so I think that's what I'm going to do. The reason I think that is because I have nothing else except that. So I'm not really preaching tonight. I'm going to share what the Lord, I think, is doing to me. But I got to give you a little bit of backstory, and that's what led up to this. This past summer, I was taken by ambulance to the hospital emergency room after I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation. What that is when your heart stops beating and starts fluttering. And mine was fluttering at about 150 beats a minute, and had been doing that apparently for a while. And I went to urgent care because my wife insisted that I do that. And she said, "You're not right," which she's told me that for 45 years. But this time I, you know, said, "Well, okay, I'll go," because I was going to the hospital anyway to see a couple of people. And so urgent care is next to the hospital. So I thought, I did it to get her off my back. And so I did, and they did some checks and said they were going to, they did an EKG, which I thought was a little overkill, but I had Medicare, so I thought, well, they're doing it for the insurance. And so the nurse practitioner said, "I'd like to talk to your wife," because they knew that she was a nurse. I said, "Sure." So I gave her the phone, and that's when I found out that they were shipping me off by ambulance to the hospital. And I said, "No, you're not." She goes, "Yes, we really are." I said, "Uh-huh." She goes, "Uh-huh." And so we got into this match going back and forth. And I said, "Well, it's like next door. I don't need to go to the ER by ambulance." She goes, "Oh, yes, you do." And finally, she said, "Look, there's two things you got to understand. Number one, you're not in charge here. And number two, I'm trying to save your life." Well, that got my attention. And so I decided to, I've learned not to argue with a nurse from long experience. And so I did, and then I got taken to, I had to meet the following. That was on a Saturday, and Monday I saw a cardiologist, and there were a whole bunch of stuff. They did a lot of stuff to me over the next few weeks and found out that in addition to the AFib, I was also in congestive heart failure. And then I went on the CDC website. Don't ever do that. I went on the CDC website where I found out that people who have diagnosed with congestive heart failure, that 50% of those die within 5 years of diagnosis. And so next time I saw the doctor, I asked him about that. And he said, well, that's true, but here's why we think that doesn't apply to you. Well, we think was not is what I really wanted to hear. But he did tell me not to give my stuff away to my kids at this point, so I'm keeping it. And so basically that was in August. And so I've been on this little journey for about 7 months. And I see I take 12 pills a day, plus a liquid medication, plus eye drops for something totally different. I've had 2 echocardiograms, 2 cardioversions. I've had enough blood to qualify as a vampire victim drawn. I have daily monitoring of my blood pressure, my heart rate, which basically is about 48 beats a minute, medically induced. I have my oxygen levels checked every day. I just finished 36 cardiac rehabilitation sessions. And for 6 of the last 7 months, with the exception of Sundays, I've been mostly at home or part-time doing things. And it's been something I'm not used to doing. I've been on limited duty for 6 of the last 7 months. And during November and December, my wife, who was retiring from University of Georgia, where she's been the associate dean for the School of Nursing, took 2 months of family leave. And when that happened, I knew she was either really tired of working or she was concerned about me. And so in a lot of ways, my Lent began early. That I say all that to say that when mortality stands up and looks you in the face, then your priorities get rearranged. And some of you know what I'm talking about. And so my Lent began early. And about a couple of months ago, and this was a really kind of a strange thing. I mean, I've been doing a lot more prayer, a lot more reading, a lot more script in the scriptures. And about 2 months ago, I started in a prayer time. I was, doing the confession. And, of course, when I do that, I always, if nobody's around, tell the Lord what it is I'm really confessing. And one of the things I started doing, and I did it with a lot of emotion, and it surprised me how much emotion, is I repented for a wasted life, for wasting my life. Now, that would surprise a lot of people. But it's not that I've wasted my life serving Him. It's just that I've been pretty selfish in a lot of my life. And I've done a lot of things, not because God led me to do things necessarily, but because I thought it'd be cool to do. And so I'd do ministry and I'd do this, and it was all good things. But I came to the place where I felt like that not knowing how much of life is left, that I look back on life and I felt like a lot of it was wasted. Does that make sense at all? I've been in ministry since I was 20 years old. I had my first church when I was 23, which is a horrible thing to happen to a church. And so that's kind of what led me up to sending a text to both Archbishop Jones and to the Patriarch that I wanted to embark on a serious and holy Lent, and I asked for their prayers and blessing. And so Lent for me this year has been serious. I mean, there's some things I've done. There's a couple of things I have set aside for now. And I've been reasonably pretty successful at that. And there's some things that I've repented of pretty strongly that, with God's help, has been successful at that. But also have done some things that are intentional. I mean, up until 7 months ago, I was a really busy guy. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't a really busy guy. And so when I started feeling better, I thought, okay, what do I need to be busy about? What do I need to actually do? Plus, I have to just confess to you that we've had people move away. I've had a couple of people get mad. I've had a couple of people just leave, and I don't know why. And in the past, that's never bothered me because I believe my own hype that I knew what to do. That I just knew what to do about church growth. And I was, I knew what to do. In fact, I've taught church growth courses, so that's how much I know. Except now. And now whatever I'm trying to do has not been working. And I really believe that the Lord gave me some insight about that during some of these prayer times I've had. You remember the story of Eli, you know, who didn't deal with his sons and eventually fell off and broke his neck. But anyway, there's a war. And the response of the Israelites was to take the ark to battle with them in this particular war. And they did that because they'd always done that. And it always worked. So instead of asking God what to do, they took the ark into battle. And the army, the Israelite army, got defeated. And the ark was captured. And they couldn't get it back. God got it back, but they couldn't get it back on their own. And so whatever they'd done, had been doing for all those times in battle, and had worked, wasn't working now. And it wasn't working now because that's not what God was doing now. And so that's where I am. I mean, that's where I am. Just being honest with you, that's where I am. And there's some things. And so I told the Lord, dear, when I got ready to start the formal Lent, the official Lent, I said, I want to let you know that I'm going to do something that I've done only rarely in my life. I quit. I don't mean I quit being a pastor. I don't mean I quit. I quit. I give up. I surrender. This is your church. And I'll do whatever you want me to do, but I don't know what to do. And so I quit. So here's what I'm going to do, Lord. I am going to be in your word. I'm going to pray as you show me how to pray. I'm not for career growth. That's up to you. This is for me. Because I need to not have the next 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 mile year. I don't want to get down the road and look back and say, well, he still wasted his life. Okay. So I'm going to try my best to be a good Christian. And you're going to have to take care of my being a good pastor, because I don't know what to do. Does that make sense to anybody? And so, also I found out that I didn't have a lot of humility. I thought I had a lot of humility until I started getting humiliated. Then I found out I had a lot of pride. And so I'm working on that, because, you know, the scripture does say to humble yourself, and if you won't, then God will help you. So at least that's what he's done with me. So let me tell you some things I've been doing, then I'll just tell you what I think the Lord has shown me. How's that? I felt like that what I wanted specifically to know what the Lord wanted me to do and to read. So it's pretty simple. Some of it's pretty simple. Some of it's stuff that I've been doing or should have been doing. For the most part, I've been preaching from the lectionary. I've been doing the daily office and the daily readings and things like that. But then there were two things that I needed to do, and had been too busy to do some of these things. And one is I wanted, and I felt led to read, in the area of the lives of the saints, not ancient saints, not early church saints, in this case, but lessons learned from monastics and martyrs, specifically of the 19th and 20th centuries, specifically men and women, and specifically the Russian and Greek Orthodox expressions of Christian faith. And I didn't really pray about that a long time or study hard about that. It's just what I felt like I should do. And so I had some of those already, and I just never gotten to them. And so for the last, I don't know, since Christmas, I've been reading those a lot. And I've been, and I'm looking for what God, for what they're doing, and I'm looking for what God is doing in their lives. And so I've been doing that, and it's opened up a different, I mean, I've read a lot of Catholic saints. I've done that. And I've read a lot of Protestant, but we might not call them saints, but Protestant. I read John Wesley just a few weeks ago. I deviated and read a book about John Wesley. And but that was where I was reading. I've watched very little television over the last, I don't know, 2 months. I do my readings while I'm listening to soft, quiet worship music. I do it downstairs. I have an icon corner down there. No, I'm not going to the Orthodox Church, but I have a guitar down there too. And besides, that's where the fireplace is, and it's been winter time, and I've built a fire, and I've been praying. And I've been praying specifically. I started out praying for a family, which, you know, you should do anyway. But I started doing that intentionally at a certain time. I'd pray for myself, you know, specifically in the area of asking God to be merciful to me, confessing my sin before Him, my need of Him. And then I prayed for my wife and my three sons and their wives and their children by name. And I prayed, I found out that my son John and his wife are expecting another child. They lost a child last year, just about a year ago, and they're expecting another child, and it's a girl. Her name is Isabella. She's not here yet, but I pray for Isabella. And so I added to that the bishops. I started up with the Patriarch up in New York because that's the place that needs God the most. And I moved down to the South where we know we need God the most. And then I prayed for our chaplains, our military chaplains, added our chaplains. And then I added all of the priests and deacons in my diocese. And then I added all the wives. And I asked our congregation before Lent to if they had anybody in their family or somebody they knew that weren't Christians, or they had been believers and they had left the faith, to put their name on a sheet of paper, and they would commit to praying for them during Lent, and I would commit to pray with them about their families and friends during Lent. There's 475 names in that box now, and last night I got to the end of the day and I wasn't at home and I realized I haven't prayed for folks, and so there's a system that I do, and so I was praying, I fell asleep, I woke up at midnight and remembered where I left off and started again. Anyway, I fell asleep 3 or 4 or 5 times, and I finally woke up this morning and finished it and realized I'm going to have to do the whole thing over again today. But that's been very beneficial to me. It's kept me from being so unintentional about things. And how long am I going to do this? I'm past Lent, that's all I know. Sometime past Lent. Because I feel like that the Lord is leading me for a changed lifestyle. And I'm not just talking about for health reasons. I'm talking about because I don't want to waste any more time or any more life. So here's what I want to share with you. And I'm not saying, and I'm not preaching to you tonight because I have no clue what God wants to do with you, you know, in your season of Lent or in times to come. And since Archbishop asked me to share what God was speaking to me, that's what I'm sharing. And, you know, when I share it with you, you may go, that's absolutely, I'm not, is he saying I should do that? No, I'm not. I'm just saying this is what I'm learning. Now, I realize we're only, 3 weeks into, 4 weeks maybe into Lent, the real Lent. And we still have up until, April 16th, till Easter. And so, but this goes back a ways prior to Lent. It's just that it sort of happened before Lent, and now it's really gotten intentional, and it's really gotten it's gotten holy, if I can use that term. So I told you what this is: lessons learned from monastics and martyrs. Most of the martyrs were killed by communists in Russia. I haven't gotten into modern martyrs at all, like those who have been the hundreds of thousands that have been killed by Muslims. I know that last year, 90,000 Christians were killed for their faith, 2016. This touches none of them. And some of these, a lot of these people were not martyrs. They died of old age or young age, somewhere in the late 1800s to the up until 1960s, I suppose. So, but here's, before I came into the CEC, and some of you will identify with this, I was a part of a denomination that when you went to clergy conferences, the first question you would be asked is, how many do you have in church? How many are you running? Anybody have that happen? Well, that's done for two reasons. One, the big reason is to compare. And if I go to Bishop Jones and I say, Chuck, how many are you running in church? And he tells me a number, and his number is more than mine, I feel resentful. So I go find somebody else, and I say, how many are you running? And if his church is less than mine, then I can feel superior. That's not supposed to be that way. That's the way it works out. And I was in that denomination for 19 years. And I have yet, in the CEC in 20 years, for anybody to ask me that question. And I have not asked anybody that question, because it doesn't matter. But it was easy. It's easy to compare with somebody else when the bar is low. Does that make sense? And so that's why a lot of folks would come and they would ask people who they knew had lower attendance than them so they could feel that they were up there somewhere. And I did the same thing. And I was very proud of the fact that out of 214 churches at the time in our state, mine was number 7 in attendance. I didn't know I was proud. I thought I handled it very humbly. But I was. And what's happened is that when I've been reading the lives of these men and women, and it's easy not to compare yourself with Jesus because he's as high as the bar as you, and none of us expect to be there. I mean, so if we say, well, you know, I'm only human. But what about these humans? What about these other humans who walked in the same paths that I've walked in? How do I compare with them? And that's helped my humility. And so here's what I've learned. And I have learned that I have a long way to go in all of these. And I hope I have time to improve. So, and there's a couple of them I'll share stories about and some I'll just let stand. What I've learned about these people that the church has designated, one of the Orthodox churches, is designated as someone to emulate, someone to look up to, and someone that they call a saint for whatever reason, that they came from all walks of life. I mean, I was amazed from how many walks of life. Some were unlearned, uneducated peasants. Some were scientists, chemists, biologists. Some were princes. Some were other royalty who gave up everything to go to. And most of these people are monastics. I think I said that. So they're in monasteries. And some were craftsmen. Some were military. I even came across one Russian general who, at the end of his military career, went into a monastery. And I thought, well, that sounds a lot like the clergy I know. We come from all walks of life. And so we're good there. I'm good there for the most part. And one of the things that I saw about all these people, men and women, is that they either had from an early age or they developed it as they went along, an incredible passion, passionate love of God. It drove them to do what they did. It drove them to leave where they were and go where they went. And that love was passionate. And this passionate love enabled these people, these men and women, to endure incredible hardship, to endure poverty, serious deprivation, and martyrdom. And for many of these people, their passionate love sustained them even when their lives were at stake. One Russian archbishop, who was now out of the monastery but over a large area, was told, he was called in after the revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, and was told that if he would, he could stay an archbishop, but if he would agree to their terms, that he would be freed, he would be made the patriarch, I think, of Moscow, and if he didn't, he would go to the concentration camps and die there. And he told him, he said, I will not inform on my congregations. I will not do your bidding. And I am willing to endure whatever punishment you wish to inflict on me. And he was one of the youngest archbishops. And he died in a work camp. There were other priests who were called in and interrogated. And one of the most interesting offers that I heard was, they said, the interrogator said, all you have to do is take off your cross. Just lay it down on the table and go home. And you're free. If you don't, you'll be arrested and you'll be sent to prison. And you may or may not get out. And one of the things that I learned is that these people who were sent off to prison, they might have their sentences extended the day before they were supposed to get out. And even if they got out, they were likely to be rearrested within a year and sent for a longer term. And they knew it. And they went back to their churches, if they were priests, or they went back to the monasteries and continued to serve God because of their passionate love for Him. And remember, I'm comparing myself to these people as I learn these things. They were committed to purity. Now, one might say that's easy to do if you go off to a monastery. But some of these people, I had fallen in love, and they had to make choices. Because now we're talking about people who, if they're monastics, are celibate. And the only way to be a priest, I don't know about other places, but in the Russian church, the only way to be a priest was either to get married first, before you got ordained, and you would serve in a local church. Or you had to go off to the monastery. And even if you were a priest and your wife died, you could never marry again. And so they had to think about that. But they were committed to purity in spite of temptations. And here's what I noticed about the temptations. The temptations that they faced the most were three. It was greed, lust, and pride. The same ones that we struggle with. Every minister. I was told when I was a young pastor that I would face the temptation of the three G's, gold, girls, and glory. Of course, I guess now it could be gold, guys, and glory, depending on your orientation. And I think that's right. I think that's right. And, I never had a problem with the gold. I would never come into CEC if that was my motivation. For some reason, I was never pursued by the girls. But I fall right in there on that pride thing. I thought I was, I didn't think I had a problem with that, but I did and do. In fact, the novices in monasteries had daily meetings with their elder and daily confessions at the end of every day. And they had promised to share openly about everything because they were committed to purity of all kinds and integrity. And they were committed to obedience. You know, all of us took vows. All of us took vows to be obedient, right? I'm not talking about wedding vows. That just came with the territory for the guys. But for our ordination, we took vows of obedience to our bishop. And that's hard. That's tough. Especially when we think he's wrong. And because contrary to, previous teachings, bishops can be wrong. But still, this obedience thing was an amazing thing to read. And there's serious obedience to an elder, or if you were a monk, or to a hierarch, if you were a priest. And not only to them, but to the rules that everyone had, and to the tasks that were given. In fact, a task was called obedience And you might be a monk and get assigned to the kitchen as your obedience, or you might be assigned to the garden as your obedience, or you may have the obedience of going for the mail, which involved sometimes a 3-day walk. But that's what it was. It was obedient. And if someone was not obedient, how can you be obedient to God, was the rationale, if you can't be obedient to an earthly figure? And the assumption was, if you can't be obedient to authorities on earth, it's impossible to be obedient to God. And so I found myself there a few times too. They were committed to hard work. If you know anything about monasteries, you know that monks, for the most part, built those monasteries by hand, themselves. They raised their own food. They cook, they cut their own firewood. They farmed, tended vineyards. They cared for the elderly and infirm of their ranks. Some people would be given the obedience to be hospitable to guests and pilgrims who came by. And so it was hard. And they worked a lot. I just always had this idea that if you're a monk, you sit around and pray. Sort of the way people think about pastors, you know. You just sit around and pray. And wait for inspiration to come. Found out they were single-minded. The goal, at least, was to allow no distractions to their call. Now, this resulted in some things in the monastery. Females could not be on monastery grounds. Males could not be on convent grounds. And they could have no contact unless it was their obedience to have contact with members of the opposite sex. There were no newspapers, politics. You didn't talk about politics. I like that one right now. Because their eye was on the eternal life. Even for the priests who were in a local church, their eye was not to be on how well the liturgy was done or whether the sermon was great or how many people were in church. Their eye was always on the eternal for these who are considered saints. Prayer. Prayer was both liturgical and personal. And they prayed so much that a question came to an elder of a monastery. And he said, how much sleep is permissible? And the elder said, 2 hours at night and 2 hours in the afternoon the following day should be sufficient for young monks. 2 hours of sleep at night and one in the afternoon should be sufficient for mature monks. And what were they doing? They were in services, or they were praying, or they were in their cell or in their room, and that was expected. Still expected. It's expected today. Fasting was not something that they did during Lent. Fasting was a way of life. Every day there was some aspect to that spiritual discipline. They saw the hand of God in all things, even the bad things. One man was thrown from a donkey back at the turn of the century and was injured, and his elder said to him, how fortunate that God permitted you to be thrown by the donkey. Now you won't have to get the mail. You can spend your time in your bed in prayer. Give thanks to God for being thrown from the donkey. It's also cut down on criticism if everything was seen as from the hand of God. And it also cut down on envy, because, you know, one of the things that I really, when I first met Archbishop Jones, who was then Canon Jones, I don't know if I first met him, but you were speaking at a clergy retreat somewhere in North Carolina. I don't remember where. And he was one of the speakers. And I remember this soft-spoken guy coming to the lectern or whatever, and he said, I know some of you out there are wondering, why am I asked to speak at this retreat? And why are you not speaking? He said, because many of you out there are far better teachers than me. You're better, you're stronger preachers. You have bigger churches. And he said, and I just want to let you know that the reason that I'm speaking tonight and you're not is because the bishop asked me to speak and he didn't ask you. And I thought that was hilarious. But I also knew that he was speaking to envy. But that was the best answer. Because you didn't get asked to. It wasn't your obedience. You know, it wasn't your task that night. It wasn't my task that night. And that's seeing the hand of God in all things. Does that make, you know, well, God, why didn't I get the promotion? Well, because God didn't let you. Well, how come they've got a new car and I don't? Because God knows you something else for you. I'm not saying God's punishing you. I'm just saying that their concept was that everything came filtered through the hand of God, even the attacks of the demonic for their benefit. And we say, well, that's not possible. And then we say, well, Jesus was led by the Holy Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. And to these folks, and we understand this a little bit here as charismatics, they had this firm belief that the unseen world was present right now. The unseen world was present. And they believed that in the activity and the reality, the present reality of both angels, of demons, they believed in the present serious intercession of the saints who had gone on before. They believed that nothing, that everything that was unseen in the spiritual realm was not absent, but was present. Does that make sense? And so, miracles were to be anticipated and expected, as was the attacks of the enemy, to be anticipated and dealt with. And the sacraments were considered to be vital. Now, I thought it was interesting in light of the teaching on sacrament this morning, because there were three sacraments that they felt were, for them, that were the most vital for them. It wasn't holy orders, oddly enough. You'd think it would be. But no. I mean, to be a monk was one thing, but some people had to be hammered into being deacons or priests. Many people refused it. The abbot would come to them and say, I want to make you a hiero monk, which is a priest who was a monk. And oftentimes they would beg on their knees, please don't do this to me. Let me just be a person of prayer. There was one person who was elected to be the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. He was so horrified by that he ran and hid in the woods. And they sent a search party for him. He was gone for days. They finally brought him back. And after he had served for several, many years as the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, he resigned, citing health reasons, because he was old. And what he did was he went to a monastery under an assumed name and asked to be received as a novice, which is hard work. Those are the guys that do the hardest jobs. And they almost didn't let him in because he was too old. He said, I promise you that you will not regret this. And he had been there for like a year or two already when somebody visited the monastery and asked the abbot, what are you doing having the retired patriarch chop wood? That caused a ruckus. But the three sacraments that they considered vital were anointing, confession, and Eucharist. The same ones that were mentioned this morning, the ones that were regular. And they took advantage of all three as often as they could. And they administered all three as often as they could. And there was a serious understanding that God was in the sacrament. And I came from an evangelical background, and most of the people who started out in our church in Georgia were evangelical, so I kind of had to redefine sacrament. I passed it through a couple of bishops to make sure I wasn't in heresy. But I defined it in a way that would fit evangelical theology. For one thing, you've got to, everything you do in church in our area, you've got to find it in the Bible first. Where's that in the Bible? It's right here. Okay. And it doesn't matter, you know. Tip incense. I don't care where you find that. Baptists don't like that. Well, it's right here in the Bible. That's not what it means. Okay. Yeah, but it's in the same book as the tithing thing. That's different. In fact, I asked a Baptist person, First Baptist Church, several years ago. I said, you guys do tithing? Yeah. You preach it? Yeah. You use Malachi chapter 3, verse 10? Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a tithing chapter. Well, what do you do about Malachi 1:11? Which one's that? That's where the Scripture says that in every place that His name, the incense will be offered in His name. When are you going to do incense, First Baptist Church? He said, you set me up. I hate you. He said, well, you have to forgive me or you're going to die mad. And so, but there was this one lady. And by the way, there were three times as many nuns as there were monks back in the days before the Bolshevik Revolution. Mostly I've read Russian stuff, some Greek. And there was one, this one lady who was what they call a desert dweller. She lived in a cell, a shack really, up in the north part of Russia. And a lot of snow. And there was a man named Father Andrew who checked on her periodically. Well, it snowed. The snow came. The blizzard came. And she was sick. It was several days before he could get there, and she was snowed in. So he actually took an axe and a shovel to get her out, to break the frozen snow and shovel her out. And when they opened the door, she was very ill. And she had no food and hadn't had food for days. And he was very upset. He goes, I'll be back. And he left. Well, in the meantime, she came to the conclusion that she was dying. She believed that the Lord had showed her that she was in her last days of life. And the thought hit her that she would die in this cell without having received anointing and communion. And so she threw some clothes around her, and she stepped out into the snow and headed for the monastery 3 miles away. And snow is deep, and she was sick. And so there's some other monks of the monastery who were doing some outside work, and someone notices this figure, and they wonder, who is that? And the figure fell. And they ran to see who that was and realized it was this nun. She went 3 miles in heavy snow, sick unto death, to receive unction and Holy Communion before she died. They took her into a place in the monastery where the monks prayed for her, and the priest came by every day to serve her communion. She was anointed, and 3 weeks later, she passed away. She passed away surrounded by people who loved her, having received the sacraments. And they said in the account that when she died, that all the wrinkles left her face. And she looked like she were 20 again. And it was a glow and a radiance. That's pretty serious. And then the last thing that I wrote down, and there's more, and I know it's been a long time, but he said I could take 3 hours. Or is it 3 minutes? Okay. Some in between? Okay. Is that there was a focus, and this one helps me. With all these men and all these women, there was a focus on the kingdom and to be faithful. Faithfulness was what mattered as they focused on the kingdom and not accomplishment. Faithfulness and not accomplishment. Doing the will of God, regardless of what that was. Regardless of how small that task was. Regardless of how obscure and hidden it was. The goal was to focus on the kingdom and be faithful to God. And I realized that as I wrote these down over a period of time, that bar is pretty high. And it challenges me. And I know that I'm a long way from where, and some of these were simple people with third grade educations. And yet, they were giants in the history of the church. And those people aren't there today. Some of the people are in this country. And it doesn't take a monastic, it doesn't take a martyr to love God with all your heart. And I read earlier, about in the unified church back before the schism, and I've read in Catholic lives as well. And I would have to say that the same characteristics, the same attributes are present in all those people. And so I want to continue my own Lenten journey well past Lent. In fact, Lent may be my new favorite season because I want my life to matter. And I want it to matter. I don't really care if it matters to... I want it to matter to God. And so that's what the Lord's been showing me. I hope that's in some way helpful or valuable. And I apologize for the length. But everybody was said today, everybody has a different path. Everybody, God's doing something different with everybody. And for now, this is my path. It's just to keep praying. I mean, I had like 175 names last night. That's why I kept going to sleep and kept waking up. And sometimes it's real, real short. Sometimes I've got a 14-year-old niece that what I really want to do in the flesh is drive up to Tennessee and slap her till she's silly because of the way she's treating her grandparents. But I'm going to do the worst thing I can do to her, and I'm going to pray for her every single day. Because she doesn't want anybody to pray for her. She said that on Facebook. I thought, well, Nanana Boo Boo, I'm going to pray for you, and there's not a thing you can do about it. I didn't tell her that. I told her grandmother that. And so, thank you for the opportunity. It's an honor to be here. And I really, really enjoyed the teachings this morning. They were just superb. And enjoy the signing. I can't do that. And I enjoyed the music too. It was wonderful. And thank you. Thank you. You married way above yourself. You know that, right?